Charles Manson, Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, Ted Bundy, the Menendez brothers. What do they have in common? They've all spent decades behind bars. We know that. But they also got married while incarcerated. Now, you see this and you wonder, why would somebody marry an inmate who's going to spend the rest of their life behind bars? And some of these women are educated and beautiful and otherwise gainfully employed. So let's talk a little bit about this with somebody who knows what this is about. With us to explain this is Dr. Catherine Ramslin, one of my favorite forensic psychologists at DeSalle University, and she's the author of 71 books, including Confession of a Serial Killer, which we're going to talk about with the BTK Killer, The Human Predator, The Mind of a Murderer, and the most recent book, The Serial Killer's Apprentice. She has appeared as an expert in criminal psychology on more than 200 crime documentaries and podcasts. She's the executive producer of Murder House Flip and is consulted for CSI, Bones, and The Alienist. Dr. Ramslin, welcome and thank you for joining me.
Hello, it's good to be here. Good to talk with you again.
So before we get to this issue of women, basically falling in love with men in prison, what is Murder House Flip? I have to tell you, I've never watched it, but I want to know what it is.
Well, it ran for 2 seasons. It's on the Roku network at this point, and it is where we took houses where murders had occurred and healed the murder space by completely, you know, renovating it and giving the homeowners a new home. They got lots of great stuff, amazing backyards and whatnot. But we started with the Dorothy Puente house. She was a female serial killer who ran a boarding house, and she buried her victims in her garden. And so we started with that house. It was really quite an interesting show to do.
Interesting. I have to go back and check it out. I definitely
yes,
do.
CSI meets HGTV.
There you go. So let's talk about this issue. And I ran into this issue, Dr. Ramslin, because I did a documentary. I was interviewed for one of the Menendez brothers documentaries. And as a result, one of the boys, they're men, their wives called me and I had some conversations and she wanted some help on some things. And I was just amazed at how she was kind, she was educated, and I thought to myself, why would you, of all the men in the world, why would you select somebody who's in prison for all this time? I know there must be different personality types, but can you give our listeners maybe some bullet points on kind of women who might fall into this category?
Yeah, we tend to want to think of them all as kind of the same, but they're not. There's a range of motives, a range of circumstances in their lives. And it's not that they set out to I'm going to be the girlfriend or wife of a famous inmate or serial killer. It's that something comes across their path and they're ready for a relationship of this nature and they fall for the person. Sometimes they've had a prison job and they meet the offender there. Doesn't always work out for them. And a few of these relationships have in fact worked. And it's not always about women going for men. Sometimes men have gotten involved with incarcerated females as well. If they're released, it may or may not work out, but it can. And it's not, I don't think you can just easily categorize and put this in a box. But some of the motives would be things like rescue fantasies. They have this sense of, that they're the ones who can make a difference in the life of this killer, and so they want to be the one to do that. Some see the little boy in the person, so they want to nurture them and believe that maybe something was missing in the life of the killer and that they can supply. Some just want the perfect boyfriend, the person who focuses on them all the time and can't go anywhere or do anything with anyone else, and yet they can go out and do what they want without doing laundry or cooking meals or being accountable. And so they can say they have a man in their life, but they don't really have the day-to-day demands of a relationship. It's very idealized kind of situation, but for some women, that's all they want.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of hard to cheat if you're a man in prison.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like
you can, but in fact, some of them run a number of these groupies, and when they find out about each other, you know, there's hell to pay in many cases because they you know start sizing each other up and competing, and so that can happen as well. Some like the drama; they just. Or they're really enticed by the exotic nature of an offender's story, and they want to be part of it. They may feel that it turns them into somebodies because this person has media attention, and that will now come to them. You know, there's a variety of reasons why they do this.
And you know, I followed this case. I don't know if you remember this. I'm trying to think. It was a couple of years ago. It was a female prison guard, Casey White, I think her name was. Mm-hmm. She helped an inmate escape from an Alabama prison, and they were on the lam for a while. Mm-hmm. And it ended up with her killing herself when the authorities were about to arrest her, and they put the guy back in prison for life. And when you see something like that, you have a Casey White who is a prison guard. Now, she's, you know, mm-hmm. she carries a gun. She learned to be law enforcement and to follow the law and to uphold the law. What, you know, again, not knowing her exactly, but mm-hmm. what category would you put her in, do you think?
Not knowing her, that it makes it hard. And again, I don't like to put them in categories because I think each person has a, you know, complex set of circumstances, but she would have, like anybody, falling in love. You know, what's the mystique? How does that happen? She met this guy and they got to talking, and very likely she enjoyed it. There was a reward factor in it for her. Maybe she thought he was, you know, unfairly sentenced. Who knows what she thought? But something happened to change her mind about the job she was dedicated to, and to believe that what she really wanted out of life was a life with this man, and that could only happen if she helped to spring him. I mean, she's not the only one to have done that, and we've had men doing it with female offenders as well. But, you know, we had the escape from, was it Dannemora, something like that, where you had the woman also helping the offenders get out. And I think it really has to do with the way emotionality can change a person's cognitive state. You know, they start to reconsider what they think is worth with living for, worth giving sacrifices for. They start to rethink who they are, their self-concept. And it's a gradual process, but eventually it seems like doing this thing, helping the offender escape or just marrying the offender, now means more to them than, you know, their job or their family, because some of them have been married and then they've left their families. So it's really, you know, like it's a human thing. The way we think of ourselves can change when we get emotionally involved with somebody. And I think that's what happens with them.
When we come back, I want to talk about it from the other perspective. And you have spoken to inmates who, let's say male inmates, who have these sort of pen pals, romantic pen mm-hmm. pals. And I want to talk a little bit about what you've gleaned from talking to them. And then I want to talk to you about something that I know everyone loves to talk to you about, and that is the BTK Killer, Confessions of a Serial Killer, which is a great book. You spent many, many hours talking to him, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that. Listen, I'm going to finish up this topic of women, and it goes both ways, but you know, women who befriend inmates, notorious inmates. You have spoken to men who have had these romantic pen pal relationships. What do you glean from talking to these men?
So what I've heard from some of them is there's kind of an attitude of, you know, they really need these women. Sometimes they don't even care about them. I'm not speaking about all relationships like this because I know that some are long-lasting, but there are times when they just realize that they're not going to get things they need, like money or items in their commissary or, you know, or news from the outside world without these outside connections, and having someone who's in love with you is a, you know, real convenience for some of them. And they can play their options where they'll acquire a number of them, hoping they don't learn about each other. Dahmer did that. Bundy did that. And it's not a good thing when these women kind of figure out there's someone else and maybe find them on social media or in some other venue, and they start comparing notes. But the men think of them as, you know, useful, and they can certainly be in love with them. But the ones that I've talked to are more thinking about them in objective ways, like they're helpful to me, I need them, and so I keep stringing them along.
Yeah, and I guess it wouldn't surprise me. And again, I've known a serial killer in my life, and they are they are very manipulative and mm-hmm. may be narcissists or sociopaths. So, you know, those are the type of people who are going to get what they want no matter what. And it doesn't matter who they hurt or harm or lie to. If they want that extra, you know, ramen noodles from the commissary, they're going to do mm-hmm. and say what mm-hmm. they need to do and say to get it.
And they also can they have a person that they can mold into the likeness they want to be. So they have a kind of a support system where this is a person who believes I'm innocent or believes it's not as bad as it seems. And they like to have that kind of person in their life.
Let's pivot a little bit and let's talk about your book, The Confession of a Serial Killer. Can you tell our listeners who Dennis Rader was or is?
Yeah, is. He's still around.
He is.
I've been talking to him since 2010, so that's 15 years now. He was a serial killer in Wichita, Kansas, starting in 1974 and murdered 10 people in Wichita until 1991. He was caught finally in 2005, and what he had picked his own moniker, BTK, meaning bind them, torture them, kill them. And so he now kind of relishes this notion that he's one of the most famous serial killers alive today, and he really loves having the attention and the correspondences, although I will say he's cut back on that quite a bit because he's been ill and can't write as well as he used to be able to do or even read some of the letters. But he likes to have some of the women who get attached to him. He does enjoy that.
Fascinating. And, you know, he was one who blended in for a long period of time. It took a long time to catch this guy. And
even 31 years.
And even his family was shocked, right? I mean, they had no clue.
Everybody, his brothers, his parents, his wife and kids and his minister and all the people who'd worked with him, everybody was shocked.
What, again, these are very loaded questions, and the books have been written in about these topics. But, you know, when you look at someone like him and you spent hours with him and you wrote about it and you studied him and you've known him for years, what are the elements that went into making a guy like him? What, you know, if you were to bullet point, you know, upbringings or you know, things that happened in his upbringing or what have you, what would you bullet point here, Dr. Ramslin?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I think it's important to study the whole trajectory of their lives to see the trigger points, because we do see with him, it starts young, where he's been humiliated by his mother, for one, teachers, because he wasn't a very good student. Females. And so he developed this sense that he wanted to keep them under his control because they made him feel off balanced. And you couple that with a growing fetish with bondage, where he would tie himself up, he would tie cats up, he would envision tying girls to the railroad track. And then he saw in True Detective magazines the kind of attention that certain serial killers had gotten, like Harvey Glattman, who also had bound his victims and photographed them. And you put a number of these influences together as they roll along. He begins to think that this is who he wants to be. He begins to envision himself as a famous serial killer too. And so one day he gets the opportunity to act on that. He does it, and he wants to keep doing it. Sometimes they develop this fantasy, they act on it, and they don't want to keep doing it. So, because it's just not, doesn't live up to the fantasy. But with him, it did, and he wanted to do it, and then named himself BTK, began to communicate with the press to make sure that he got the coverage. It was around the time Ted Bundy was kind of out there as well, and he wanted that kind of coverage. He wanted to be kind of Jack the Ripper, that everybody would remember BTK because he never got caught, but he did get caught.
And with all the time you spent, did he ever exhibit any remorse for what he did?
Yeah, it depends on what day you talk to him.
Right. Yeah.
Here and there, it would revolve around to that was the day he wanted to say he was sorry, but quite often it was more about feeling ownership over his victims and really liking the fact that his name is out there in the press, and that means he has to be the serial killer.
And is there any doubt that, you know, had if he were in good health now and for some reason he was released, that he would continue on doing what he was doing?
No doubt for me, no.
Nope.
I think he definitely would.
Let's talk about your most recent book. You came on the show with your co-author, Tracy Ullman, to talk about The Serial Killer's Apprentice. Can you tell our listeners about this book and the crime and the crimes and what the goal of this book was?
Okay. Well, this, too, reaches back into the 1970s. Elmer Wayne Henley Jr. was 15 when he was recruited and leveraged by an adult serial killer, Dean Corll, into bringing and helping bring young other boys in that Corll could assault, torture, kill, and then have his accomplices bury. And Wayne was part of that, and he's the only accomplice to a serial killer who killed the killer to end it. But as a result, there was somebody had to pay the price, so he ended up in prison, and he's been there 51 years. The other accomplice is David Brooks, who died from COVID a few years back. And so Wayne wanted to have his story out there as a way to warn kids against adult predators and to alert communities of the kinds of things you look for in a predator who's trying to, he not only is grooming his prey, he's grooming potential accomplices in kids, and he's grooming a community to look the other way, which is exactly what Dean Corll did. Nobody thought this man could have ever killed 29 boys. Nobody, because he was such a nice guy.
Well, and what was interesting about the book was I got the sense, and maybe you did too, having spent time with him, is that, you know, he didn't seem like he was a bad kid. You know, he came from a family that was not a bad family. Maybe he mm-hmm. was lacking
right.
in some parental support and mm-hmm. money and all of that type of thing. But like in another life, he could have been a productive member of society. And my guess is if he were released, he would never do this kind of thing again. But
he would never do it. He's a good contrast to Dennis Rader. He wanted to be a minister.
Right.
I mean, that's the kind of kid he was. He read his Bible every day, but he did have an abusive alcoholic father who had shot at him and then abandoned the family. So he did have come from a home with adverse circumstances, leaving him very vulnerable to someone like Dean Corll.
And it's hard for people to believe that a kid can be pulled into something like this. But, you know, John Wayne Gacy had two people who mm-hmm. helped him. And, you know, they weren't bad kids to begin with. And,
right.
you know, and then there's pressure that's put in extortion and threats. Mm-hmm. And I know that Dean Corll threatened this kid and told him, you know, mm-hmm. his family was going to die. And so it's a very, very fascinating psychological study, and I would highly recommend it. I'm going to thank you, Dr. Kathryn Ramsland, so much for coming on my show. Where can people can go on Amazon and put your name in and get all of your books, Serial Killer's Apprentice, Confession of a Serial Killer, and where can they contact you?
I'm on Facebook. I'm on Instagram. I have a website for my novel series that you can contact me through there.